Welcome to the Natural Selection Presents Origins. Welcome back, listeners, to the Natural Selection Presents. We are the Natural Selection. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have Nick.
Hello.
We have Naomi.
Hi.
And we have other Nick. Hello. We've gathered here this week to talk about Origins. But before we do, Naomi, do you want to tell the listeners who we are?
Yes. So we are the Natural Selection. We are a group of taxonomists, and we want to bring our passions and love of nature into the wild. Each week we meet up and we discuss the natural world. In the first part, we talk about news. So we pick a research topic from the last couple of weeks and talk about it. And in the second section, we pick a different theme and we talk about all the plants and animals and how they relate to that theme. This week's theme is origins.
Awesome. Thanks, Naomi. So how have your weeks been? Have you had any exciting nature interactions where you've been?
I saw something this week and I thought, like I sometimes do, ooh, remember that for the podcast. But I don't remember what it was.
We did a terrible job, Nick.
A butterfly. I saw a butterfly. I saw my first butterfly in months. I saw a butterfly fly from far distance, and it came right towards me, and then it went past me. And I thought, spring is finally here.
That's a nice image. What color was it?
Yellow.
Sort of a buttery butterfly.
Like a lemony butterfly.
Lemony butterfly. Lemony butterfly, yeah. Sounds like a superhero in a children's book or something.
Oh, okay, I'm writing that down.
I thought it sounded like a cake.
I was actually thinking like a lemony herb sauce for a chicken.
So how about you, Gnomes? Seen any insects or anything bigger?
Yes, so something a little bit bigger. The magnolias have started blooming near me, which is really beautiful. A really nice sign of spring. Haven't noticed any butterflies yet, but I'm sure over the next week or so, I'll probably start to see some more insects. The weather is definitely improving a little bit, so hopefully I'll start to see more things.
I had a strange occurrence, which made me worry for the safety of a small animal. I was in my bedroom, and a spider's web appeared, and I got sort of excited, being like, oh, a spider. Spider hasn't been in it the entire time I've been looking, which means either there's a rogue spider in my bedroom, or like that spider just got lost and didn't find their web again, which is, yeah, a bit sad. Or maybe they just thought my room is so devoid of insects and other things that it could possibly eat, that it abandoned my room altogether and went to find somewhere new to catch insects. Who knows? And let's be honest, who cares? That's not why we gather here today to talk about the state of my room. We're here today to talk about nature news. And I want to start us off this week with a bit of insect chat, as I want to do. So I saw this week there's a new plan for a UK-wide insect superhighway. I know what you're thinking. What is an insect superhighway? So this is a project and it's called Beelines. And what this is, so in the UK, there are many places where the wildlife is preserved and there's really good locations for wild animals to live and they have a suitable habitat. Now, the problem is in between these places are often big cities or roads or things that the insects can't cross, which is a really, really big problem if you want to get these populations into breeding or enabling the insects that are thriving in these wild areas to be able to spread to the rest of the UK. And this is especially important for pollinators and things like that. So what this is a plan to create superhighways for these insects to stop them being sort of marooned on islands of suitable habitat. So they can actually spread between these habitats and increase their range. And what it is generally a plan to help people plant wildflowers and appropriate flowers in their gardens. So it can create this sort of channel between one area and the next. So rather than having to take one big leap of many, many miles, you could go from one garden to the next garden, to the next garden, to the next garden over many generations. And yeah, eventually that these wild populations of insects would be able to, yeah, spread around the UK. It's a project by Bug Life.
Not to be the cynic here, but it sounds to me kind of like it's sort of like, whoops, we industrialized too quickly. Let's put some nature back in by making gardens.
I think you pretty much described the history of the UK.
Which is good. We love gardens. We love pollinator gardens. Great. I'm happy for that.
I think I have heard about that before. It's really cool. It's a really nice idea. And I think particularly because fragmentation is such an issue for species for problems for species diversity, because if species are kind of getting into are getting stuck, if they're getting in a bottleneck with their genetics as they're not mixing, it can be very problematic. So it's good that this is kind of something that's addressing it, and it sounds like it's kind of using a citizen science approach, which I think it could be interesting.
Yeah, I'm really excited for it. Not as excited as when I read the title of your news, Nick, which sounds amazing.
Doesn't it? And so in our little research notes that we have, a little header that says mice with giraffe genes. I have to say, first of all, that as exciting as that sounds, no, it didn't make really tall mice, alas. This was a study published in Science Advances by a team of international researchers, mostly based in China, who were trying to experimentally validate some hypotheses they had about physiological adaptations in giraffes to their unique body structure. So basically thinking, what is it about giraffes that lets them survive even though their heads are so high up there and their limbs are so long? That sort of thing. You know, the questions that I'm sure many of you stay up late at night thinking about. One way that they went about this was using some cutting-edge gene editing technology. Try saying that 5 times fast. So what they did was they compared the genome of giraffes with other ruminants. And those of you who have listened to previous episodes know that I love my ruminants. Those are our deer and bovids and other things. They gathered a list of things that were specific mutations in the genome of just giraffes. These were mostly related to cardiovascular health, bone growth, as you can imagine, vision, hearing, and sort of daily rhythm cycles. An interesting suite of mutations, but particularly they found one gene, FGFRL1, specific to giraffes, and an outlier that had 7 unique amino acid substitutions that weren't found in any other ruminant. And then they put it in mice. They put it in mice with CRISPR. And these mice that had this giraffe gene spliced into their genome showed exceptional resistance to hypertension or high blood pressure and higher bone mineral density, which are both connected to high stature in giraffe, things that you'd need if you have really big bones and have your head really high up above your heart. You need to be able to survive if you have really high blood pressure to pump the blood up there. And if you have really thick bones or really long bones, you need them to be quite sturdy. So it was cool to see these physiological hypotheses about the functional morphology working in the genome through mice.
That is cool. And it's always nice to hear that ruminants are dear to you.
Listen, I think about them often. One could even say I ruminate on them.
Brilliant. There we go. Wonder where you're going with that. Yeah. Naomi?
The piece of research that I found was looking at climate change and how that might affect the movements and ranges of animals. So this piece of research was published in Global Change Biology, and it was a study that was conducted by a team of 16 scientists, and they were led by the US Geological Survey. So it was looking at tropical species within the US and looking at how climate change and the effects of warming winters and how that will affect the range of these cold-sensitive organisms. So they looked at a wide range of tropical plants and animals in the southern US. Because climate change is reducing the number of sub-freezing days, this is providing these cold-sensitive animal or organisms with the opportunity to move further north. So this could potentially displace temperate species. And also this study found that not only was this gradual change an issue, but also the decrease in the extreme cold events has also been an issue, because these species would be limited by their ability to survive in the cold. But if it's not as cold as it used to be, they can push further. So some of the knock-on things that are either currently happening or that they think might happen, there's some salt marsh plants from temperate areas that are getting displaced by cold-sensitive mangrove forests. And this is happening on the Gulf and the southern Atlantic coast. There's also other grasses that are moving into southwestern deserts, and these are fueling wildfires in plant communities that have not evolved with wildfires, so this could be quite problematic. Another thing is that tropical mosquitoes might move up and bring with them viruses and diseases, and also pests might move as well, so such as the southern pine beetle, that can be really devastating for forestry, so that can be an issue as well. There are other animals that are moving up, and this may kind of be a positive. So manatees and sea turtles seem to be extending their range, which could be good because they're species that can be struggling. But some people are not looking forward to the spread of the Burmese python, which also is moving north. So this is an interesting piece of work, I thought, and it was looking at the effects that climate change will have and how this might impact species moving and how this might have knock-on effects for the areas they're moving into.
Great to hear about the sea turtles and the manatees. Honestly, I kind of like snakes, so that's pretty cool, but boo to the mosquitoes.
Yeah, harsh.
Listen, it bugs, Nick. It bugs. Not even true ones.
No, you're right. They're flies.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that is depressing, but interesting. And it does bring us to the end of the news. Do join us after this short break, though, where we'll be back to talk about our topic, which this week is origins. Welcome back, listeners, to The Natural Selection Presents. It's now the part of the show where we start to talk about our theme, and this week's theme is origins. And I thought a good place to start for us, as we're all at heart taxonomists, was with a very important person, Carl Linnaeus. But not just anything about Carl Linnaeus, something very specific, something to do with the origins of what we love. So I imagine most people listening to this will have heard of Carl Linnaeus. He was a Swedish man who standardized nomenclature for plants and animals. And what this means is, around the world, me and Nick face this problem when we try and talk about animals with people in Germany. Because while their English is very, very, very good, they have no reason to learn the English, for example, for heron. So when we point in the sky and say, can you see that heron? They only know the German word. So how would scientists solve this problem when there are many, many different languages? And they did this through scientific nomenclature, which is the binomial naming system, where every living thing has a binomial name of its genus and its species. So we have one, we're Homo sapiens. And this was standardized by Carl Linnaeus. And the origins I want to talk about was the origin of books that he wrote. And one of them is Systema Naturae, which is a hugely important book for us. And the first edition was released way back in 1735. But this first edition isn't really the origin for us, which is sort of strange to say. But back then, he hadn't standardized the binomial nomenclature. So there were still things with three Latin names. So they might have an extra Latin word tagged on, which we don't use anymore. But there were different ways of naming things. Some species even had like five Latin names. But in the first edition, it was close to nearly 10,000 species. And it was divided into animal, mineral, and vegetable or plant, which is where we get that parlor game from, animal, mineral, or vegetable. And there are ways to list every creature, a living thing, and mineral that Carl Linnaeus knew. But the one that we refer back to is the 10th edition of Systema Naturae, which was in 1758. And in taxonomy, this is considered year zero. So old names always take precedence. So if something has been named, the older name is always the more important one, except in exceptional circumstances. Say if there was an old name that no one had noticed, and the second name has become extraordinarily popular. So for example, Tyrannosaurus Rex. If they found a paper where someone had named Tyrannosaurus Rex a year before, and the convention would be, well, the older name has to be the new one, they would say, well, no, Tyrannosaurus Rex is so well known that it would be stupid to change, so we're going to override this for this instance. But the earliest considered time is 1758, and that is because when the 10th edition of Systema Naturae was released. And this was the first book which sort of standardized this binomial naming system. But this might come as a surprise to you two, as it came as a surprise to me. What if I told you that there is a book that was published earlier, which is actually used by taxonomists as a reference point and takes precedence over things Carl Linnaeus has written?
Is it the one about the marriage lives of the plants?
No.
Oh, okay.
This is only about animals, and it's another Swedish book. This one was printed in 1757, so a year earlier, but even in taxonomic, when it says when this name was named, they still label it as 1758 because that was year zero, but the book was actually printed a year earlier. And the reason you two don't know about it, and I didn't know about it, is because, Nick, in a different life, you might have known about this because of your interests. This was a book called Svenska Spindlar, or Aronai Svechichi, which
spiders?
Is yes. Swedish Spiders by Carl Alexander Clerk. And this was printed in 1757 and used the binomial naming system, which was popularized by Linnaeus a year earlier before he printed his Systema Naturae 10th edition in 1758.
This is the most exciting thing that we've ever talked about on our podcast.
So this predates it. Yeah, so this is actually, it will be labeled as 1758, but these names were given in 1757. And the reason that this binomial naming was used is because while this is true for animals, this is year zero, this is not true for plants. Because in his heart, Linnaeus was a botanist and he liked describing plants. The first time he standardized his binomial naming system for plants was much earlier. It was 1753 in his book Species Plantarum. And this is year zero for botanists. So botanists actually, technically existed before zoologists, which I imagine they're proud of.
Definitely. They definitely are. No, actually, Nick, this is a topic for another podcast, a whole podcast episode on its own. But botany was long considered a real something worth studying long before zoology because of its medicinal purposes.
Yes, you often find things like physics gardens and in cities and botanic gardens being very, very old, long before zoos appeared. Because, yeah, characters like Thomas Culpeper appeared writing about which plants to grow and their medicinal properties. But yeah, I thought that was quite a surprising origin of the binomial naming system for you two and hopefully for our listeners. Yeah, gave them a little bit of a shock. And if it inspired any sort of sense in you, Nick might be able to explain why.
Well, I hope so. It inspired in me a sense of awe and wonder, which is what I want to talk about now. So thinking about origins, we all sort of had, I think we should just say, call it out. We had some weird topics this week. So as you'll see, as we keep going through the podcast, we first started with Linnaeus, and now I want to talk about wonder. And I was thinking, why do we wonder? Why do we feel a feeling of awe? Where does that come from? Does it serve some sort of evolutionary purpose? And I think these sorts of questions, it's worth thinking at the very beginning that these are interesting to consider, and having a sort of clear yes or no or here's why is always tricky with this sort of question, at least in what we know now in this paradigm of 21st century science. But with that in mind, I read a lot of research about wonder and the source of wonder and maybe some evolutionary connections that it had, and a lot of it seemed like there was a lot of pseudoscience, but some of it seemed interesting. And there was a study in particular carried out by researchers in North America in 2015, published in the journal Emotion, that explores the effects of positive emotions on physiological health. And so the reason that they were doing this study and that they explained is because there's been a long history of studies looking at the negative impacts that negative emotions have on health, but not much research on the impacts on health that positive emotions have. So they were looking for correlations between different positive emotions and physiological responses. And one of the few things that they found was statistically significant in their study was a correlation between awe and a reduction of inflammatory cytokines, which are a suite of secretions by the immune system that cause inflammatory response, which can have, in some cases of illness, a sort of localized helpful response, but in general tend to have a sort of overall negative impact on health. So they were basically seeing that awe experiences reduce this inflammatory response. But why? And in this study, they have some hypotheses, and take these as you will, but I'll just walk you through a couple of them. And one of them, some of them have to do with more immediate physical responses, and others have to do with the social development and evolution of humans. So first, they're thinking that these inflammatory chemicals in the body, usually in sickness, encourage social withdrawal, and they reduce exploration and keep the individual sort of where they are, having sort of some sort of pain response or inflammatory response. It's restrictive in many ways, and that can actually help you recover from an injury or sickness. But on the other hand, if awe reduces that inflammatory response, it's also associated with an increase in curiosity and a desire to explore. And these are shown in other related studies. But that sort of suggests the opposite, that this sort of awe experience reducing that inflammatory response encourages exploration and curiosity, which I don't think I need to explain why those things would be useful for something to explore their surroundings. But that may not be all. So socially, awe also elicits feelings of interconnectedness with others. And perhaps it affects these cytokine levels by fostering social connection and supportive relationships, and in that way reduces inflammatory response. It seems like in many ways, awe lies on the opposite end of the spectrum from many negative emotions, which are known to provide inflammatory activity, to provide inflammatory response. So while this doesn't have a clear sort of conclusion, it does seem that positive emotion like awe and wonder may have evolved in some way to have a positive impact on health.
Cool. I never really thought that I'd be amazed at something for my health.
I know. Or that you'd be amazed at being amazed at something.
Yeah. Wow, that's meta.
That is really fascinating. That's so cool. I'm sad that I don't have any sort of pain that I can test this all working on.
Well, in another...
Do you want us to give you emotional pain, Naomi?
No, I didn't say. The study didn't say I've ever done that.
Or your smell. Anything you want, really. We've got loads in the bank. Don't worry.
I'll save them for another time, you know.
Okay.
Thanks, though.
When you really need it. Me and Nick will be there for you. We promise. And it's your turn, Naomi. Again, audience, sneak behind the curtain. We all picked wildly disparate topics, and picking a segue between the two is almost impossible. So from wonder, Naomi, we are going to...
Well, we're going to a very wonderful thing about nature. I wanted to talk about flowering plants. I guess inspired by spring and all the beautiful plants that are flowering, I wanted to talk about where flowering plants evolved and the origins of flowering plants. Because it was really a very important evolutionary step. They provided a huge range of niches and diversification. Botanists call flowering plants angiosperms. So this comes from the Greek words for vessels and seeds. And so instead of like conifers, which have their seeds in open cones, angiosperms have their seeds in fruit. So what's interesting about flowering plants is, and actually Darwin actually remarked on the seemingly explosive diversification of angiosperms as an abominable mystery, because there seems to be all of a sudden this huge range of flowering plants in the fossil record, and they just seem to suddenly appear. And this kind of went a little bit against some of Darwin's ideas, because he was going for the kind of gradual evolution of things. So this is kind of an interesting debate. And even now it still sort of rages on about where these angiosperms originated and then what actually is driving their diversity and why are there so many of them. So traditionally, paleobotanists would look at the fossil record and they dated the origin of angiosperms to the Cretaceous, so talking about 145 million years ago, so the early Cretaceous. This is kind of towards the end of dinosaurs, but there is a lot of diversity at this point, and this is contrasted to what molecular studies tell us. I'm looking at DNA, and this is giving an earlier time frame. So I think the earliest ones it's giving is about 70 million years earlier, in about the late Triassic. So this is kind of conflicted, and it's quite an interesting topic. So I actually don't have an answer for you guys. This is still something that they're working on, but these two areas are conflicted in what they're finding. There's strengths and there's weaknesses in both arguments. So obviously the fossil record, just because it's not in the fossil record doesn't mean that it wasn't there. There's that idea. But also with molecular evidence, there are many things that can affect what's showing up in the molecular record and the dates of those. And it can be hard to pinpoint these things. But I thought I wanted to bring up flowering plants as an idea, because there's also ideas about the fact that flowering plants diversified because of pollinators. And this is another sort of interesting discussion in this topic, because there's also a lot of controversy about when insects evolved and when these pollinating insects evolved, and their dates are argued as well. So
I was amazed by this. Kew Gardens, when they looked at the origins, there was even a theory that they might have evolved in water plants.
Cool.
Mm.
And the flowering structure, while it's sort of become this specialized thing that we recognize and how it's used, that it was actually originally a response to growing in water.
Cool.
That's really cool. I actually hadn't come across that in what I was looking at, but that's... And I do think actually, yeah, water lilies are some of the kind of earlier plants, so that would make sense.
I researched some flowering plants this week.
Oh?
Perhaps one of the most famous flowering plants in the world. In the world. I researched apples. Naomi is currently holding an apple and looking really happy about it. I want to talk about apples. And there's a few reasons for this, because I was thinking about origin. And this made me think of oranges. And I thought, well, what's like an orange? Not an apple. So I'll talk about that. They're as different as apple and oranges, honestly. Yeah, thanks.
It's true.
And the other reason was that there's this relationship with apples and sort of the biblical beginning of earth. They're often talked about as the forbidden fruit is portrayed as an apple, even though in the Bible it never mentions apples. But the origins of apples are really, really interesting. Do you guys know where apples are from? Don't say little.
No, but no, I don't.
I want to say Europe, but that might be wrong.
You are wrong, which is, it's not often I get to say that, so I said it with a relish.
Was it from Marco Polo brought them back from China?
Much earlier. So they're not Chinese, but they are from sort of that Asia, the gap between Europe and Asia, sort of one big landmass when you actually look at it. Their origins are thought to be Kazakhstan. They're native to the mountains of southern Kazakhstan, is what they think is the original wild apple. And using genetic studies, the domesticated apple, which is Malus domestica, appears to be related to Malus sieversii, which is, yeah, found in these mountain ranges, which I believe is the Altai Mountains. Now, apples are really, really interesting because they're often depicted in art and there's a massive cultural history about them, so we can sort of track their movements. And they've actually found evidence of apples existing in Europe over 2,000 years ago. And they think that was because of trade. Now, if you look at an apple, it's actually probably quite a difficult thing for an animal to eat. So it's a member of the rose family, the Rosaceae, and a lot of the fruit there, like raspberries, blackberries, all these things are quite small that birds can eat and then spread the seeds far and wide. But a bird can't really eat an apple. That's quite difficult. So what it appears is the apple evolved to be eaten by megafauna, which would then wander off and, deposit their seeds around. And they still are eaten by big animals. So bears still eat apples to this day and spread their seeds, as well as horses. But as you guys very well know, this area historically, before humans, there was much, much more megafauna, much, much more bigger animals that would be able to spread these seeds around. It appears the main animal that caused the spreading of these seeds was humans, that it became domesticated and it spread along the Silk Road. And from Kazakhstan, it went to China, and China is where half of the world's apples are produced today. But it also went the other way to Europe. Apples, they were found at least 2,000 years ago in Europe. So this trade is very, very, very old. It's not like a modern thing where you can sort of trace the origins of tomatoes. It appears they just were traveling across these trading routes and they were a desired fruit. And what I found most interesting about this is, have you heard that thing that if you plant an apple seed and grow, you won't get the same apple?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so if you plant a seed for an apple and you've got a really, really delicious apple, you're like, I want to grow some more of this. You plant the seed and you grow the tree. It takes ages, right? And then the apples grow and it grows a disgusting different type of apple. And this is quite common. So fruit domestication is actually quite different to things like grasses, like wheat. The reason is apples are grown by cross-pollination. So while this tree might have the genes to create this brilliant fruit, the pollinator might have brought pollen from another type of apple. Because different seeds express different genes, if you planted the seeds from one apple next to each other, you would get five different trees, potentially. They're all expressing different genes, and they might have been cross-pollinated with a different species. And not apples, unusually, some trees of apples can self-pollinate, but not many can. So they can't pollinate with themselves to sort of basically clone. And it means that different genes get expressed, and including some primitive ones, which might have existed before domestication, meaning the apple doesn't actually taste that nice and could be really, really sour. So this sort of amazed me that even after all this time, it's quite difficult to grow apples. Seems like a bad ending, but I'm going to end there.
I feel like it's much more complex than I ever could have imagined. I wouldn't like to be an apple farmer.
Yeah, particularly given the like huge variety of apples that are like widely available. It's like, I'm so surprised that it's that difficult. I wonder how they control these.
What they do is they splice. There's different ways of cultivating plants. So rather than planting the seeds, they can splice onto a trunk of an already growing tree. And it's all these things about plants that I don't really understand. Because you can't do this with animals, but they can with plants. Obviously, if you eat apples too quickly, you might get hiccups. Isn't that right, Nick?
That's true. That's commonly known. That's a true fact that we only tell true facts on our podcast. And it connects smoothly into from one subject to the next. Mine, the origin of hiccups. I haven't had hiccups, blessedly, in a couple of months, but I can vividly remember the last time I had them because they're so horrible to have. I think that everyone would agree, including cats and other mammals, because they also get hiccups. It doesn't seem so common, but it is in other animals as well. In fact, nearly all tetrapods have hiccups. In order to get to the root of it, we really have to figure out first what it is. What exactly is a hiccup? It's a reflex, first of all. And the reflex is it's a sort of stereotyped response of different muscles and nerves. And so what happens first in a hiccup is a twitch of the muscles in the outer body wall, diaphragm, neck, and throat in succession, which is caused by a spasm in one or two of the major nerves that control breathing. The result of the spasm is a sharp intake of air, and very soon after, about 35 milliseconds, a flap of tissue in the back of our throats closes and stops the air from going any farther. That flap of tissue, by the way, is called the glottis, and we use it a lot in speech, actually. It's the thing that lets us say, pass the guac. Both G, the G, and the K sound are glottal stops. They're things that cause the glottis to close over the air passage.
Of course, you can me and Amy would say, pass the guacamole.
Pass the guac. What you can do, Nick, is say butter. Do it for me
butter.
Now. Or without the T's, if you will.
Bah.
Yeah, the which I can't do, is a glottal stop as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that's a glottal stop, and it happens at the end of the... So first there's the intake of air, and then the hic, the glottal stop. That's what the hiccup, which each hiccup is. So, interestingly, just a brief aside about hiccups, you can stop them if you act fast. If you regulate your breathing and calm down your breath within the first 5 or 10 hics of the hiccups, you're likely good to go. They'll stop. But if you miss that window of the first 5 or 10, they continue for an average around 60 hics. So, but in some cases, there's pathological hiccups, which in one record-breaking instance lasted from 1922 to 1990. Naomi just made the most horrified face. That's exactly what I thought upon reading this. Was like, I can't stand having hiccups for more than a couple of minutes, let alone almost 90 years. Almost 80 years.
The good thing about that is if you got hiccups and someone told you this could last 80 years, that would scare you. So.
Yeah, yes, it would. Yeah, it would. That would stop it. So, but let's get to the origins. So in order to figure out where these are coming from, let's break it down. We have first the intake of air and then the glottal stop. So the hiccups. Yeah, I'm sure those were very clear noises that I just made. So let's start with the nerve spasm. This comes deep, deep in our ancestry, our shared ancestry with fish, actually, which in both fish and in humans and in other tetrapods, the nerves that control breathing originate at the brainstem. And in fish, this totally makes sense. The brainstem, those nerves, and the gills that do the actual breathing are all right next to each other. They're up at the sort of base of the head. And it makes sense to have the nerves, the things that tell the breathing to happen, close to the place where the impulses originate for the breathing. So you have like someone in a little, computer box saying, breathe, breathe, breathe. And the nerves are right there. It works. Alas, when we moved onto land and developed lungs, they moved down in the body cavity. We don't have our lungs in our necks anymore. We have them in our chest, which is quite far away from our brainstem, which is where those impulses for breathing still come from. But in order to get to the breathing apparatus, they have to go much farther. And those nerves now sort of wrap around and move into the body cavity. They're not a direct line, basically. And anything that gets in the way or interferes with the impulses coming from the brainstem to the breathing can cause a spasm, which then causes the beginning of the hiccup response. So those spasms are really a result of our inner fish, if you will. And a lot of this research I was reading in an amazing book about our evolutionary origins by Neil Shubin called Your Inner Fish. But the second part of the response, the hic, the glottal stop, is actually not coming from fish, but something that we share with amphibians, and in particular with tadpoles. Tadpoles breathing with gills. And as you know, tadpoles begin to develop both lungs and gills in their early lives, and they can switch back and forth between breathing with lungs and breathing with gills. But in order to breathe with gills, something that they really don't want is to have air getting in the gills. It can really mess things up. So the pattern of the hiccup reflex in humans is just the same as in tadpoles. In order to pump water into their mouths and throat and across the gills, but without getting water into their lungs, they close the glottis, which closes their breathing tube. So they can switch from breathing with their lungs to breathing with gills and not worry about drowning because of what's basically an extended form of hiccup. Great for tadpoles, not so great for us, but doesn't cause too much harm, so we still have it.
I just love that you got to say the sentence, great for tadpoles, not so great for us.
One of my goals for this podcast. Check.
Cool.
That's really cool. I for some reason I always thought that hiccups was like a mystery, although they didn't know why we had hiccups, but I'm glad to know that that's not the case.
My nana told me why we have hiccups.
What did she say?
She told me when I was a kid that we have hiccups because it's our body growing, which I kind of like, because to a kid it sort of does feel like you're stretching.
Huh. Nick, well, that may not be
true.
Literally true. I'm sure we can somehow interpret it to make it also still true.
I'm not sure we can. It's fine. It was literally an old wives' tale.
But there's a lot of wisdom in those, so.
Yes. And from one story about the milk of human kindness, Naomi, you wanted to talk where this milk might have come from.
Transitions today, flawless.
So I was trying to look at human evolution and some kind of origins within humans and things that have evolved that we've been able to work out in humans. And something in particular that is really, it's a really classic example of natural selection working on humans, and, you know, we can witness human evolution at work. And that is the consumption of milk from dairying animals. So what this is in most humans, the ability to digest lactose, which is the main carbohydrate that's present in milk, declines rapidly after weaning because the levels of the enzyme that's needed for this, lactase fluorescein hydrolase, decline. So this is primarily expressed in the small intestine and where it hydrolyzes lactose into glucose, so making it something that we can absorb. And lactase non-persistence, so not being able to keep lactase, is the ancestral state. And interestingly, in several populations of humans, being able to keep lactase evolved about 5,000 to 10,000 years ago. Do you guys have any ideas what this may have evolved to coincide with?
The domestication of the dog. No, that was earlier. Sorry, I don't know.
Is it the invention of pizza?
No, so it's actually the domestication and using dairy animals. So this coincides quite nicely with the culture of animal husbandry and using animals to have milk. So actually, a lot of people still in the world don't actually keep lactase. So a lot of people are lactose intolerant. In European populations, a single mutation is responsible for the phenotype of being able to absorb and consume milk, whereas in other parts of the world, so in Africa and the Middle East, and again, these populations map quite well with places that use pastoralism and that are dairying populations, they have different mutations, and there's several different mutations that are associated with the ability to continue to consume milk as an adult in those populations. And so I think this is a quite cool example of how they've been able to show a kind of a cultural and genetic match where things that we have done as a culture and society have affected our genetics. Having said that, there are some examples that don't fully match with this. So one of those is in Central Asian populations. So there are some Central Asian populations that have dairy animals and they do consume milk, but they would be lactose intolerant, but they don't have any intestinal problems. It doesn't seem to cause them problems. But what's interesting is a lot of these populations will actually consume fermented milk. So fermented milk can be easier to digest, so it can tend to not cause as many of these digestional problems. So when you don't have this lactase, the lactose sits in your intestines and it can cause some people, but not all, intestinal discomfort. So the benefit that you get from having lactase, in this theory anyway, is that you're able to take on extra nutrients, but also you don't get this, you don't get these negative effects of like an upset stomach or losing nutrients because you have diarrhea or something like that. So I thought that this would be kind of a fun example of an origin of something in humans. It does map quite well, and that is like their main theory as to why some populations are able to keep consuming milk and some aren't, because it matches with the benefit that you get from being able to consume this resource. So being able to consume milk as an adult and those calories that it provides is why they think that this genetic mutation has occurred. But it is interesting that this doesn't seem to match for all populations, because there is another theory that this genetic population arose and therefore those group of people then became dairy farmers. And that kind of does work as well. But I think the theory that is widely considered in literature is that this is a example of natural selection because of our use of dairy animals.
Cool. It's really, I mean, with the hiccup thing, it's another way of sort of seeing how things that we're familiar with have come to be because of our evolutionary past. But like you said, that's much more of a, almost like an immediate, the hypothesis there is much more immediate connection with the world that we know and can see and understand, like natural selection made writ large on us. It's cool.
Thanks, James. That was amazing. And it's good to know that I am safe to keep drinking milk, as that's how I take my tea. Also, I don't know how I'd eat cereal.
Dry, like a...
A crisp white wine, Nick.
Yes, thank you.
Which interestingly is how Nick takes his cereal.
And my tea.
Yeah, just a bit of Riesling.
And my water.
But yeah, that does bring us to an end of another episode. We will be back next week, of course, where our topic, speaking of Riesling, will be altered states. So we do hope that you join us on that topic. But for now, having finished our talk about origins, it's time for us to say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
I like the idea that, yes, you just edit us together at the end, being like, the listeners all smell
wonderful.